Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Algeria, where Gaddafi's family have just taken refuge, and talk with Laurie Brand, Professor of International Relations at USC, who studies North Africa. We'll examine the regional implications of the fall of the Gaddafi dictatorship for the neighbouring states, in particular Algeria, where the ruling regime supported Gaddafi and are now being asked to turn over his family. Then we'll get an update on the big storm and its aftermath from Andrew Revkin, who is the creator of the New York Times .earth blog, where he covers global environmental issues and climate change. We will discuss Hurricane Irene and its possible relationship to climate change, as a growing number of serious weather events are occurring with increasing devastation, requiring more and more federal disaster assistance. Then finally, we will talk with Glenn Carl, a former CIA interrogator of a suspected high-level al-Qaeda member. His new book, The Interrogator and Education, tells a story, and we will also ask Glenn Carl about Dick Cheney's defense of torture in his new memoir and the CIA's censorship of FBI agent Ali Soufran's new book that accuses the agency of missing a chance to derail the 9/11 terrorist attack. Joining us now is Laurie Brand, who is the Robert Granford Wright Professor and Professor of International Relations at the University of Southern California. Laurie Brand specializes in North Africa and Middle East international relations and inter-Arab politics, and she is a past president of the Middle East Studies Association of North America. Her books include Citizens Abroad, Emigration and the State of in the Middle East and North Africa, and Women, the State and Political Liberalization, Middle Eastern and North African Experiences. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laurie Brand.
Thanks very much, Ian.
And apparently a convoy of Mercedes limousines, armored Mercedes, crossed the border into Algeria at the southwestern Libyan town of Hadamis into Algeria, and the Algerian foreign minister has made a public statement saying that Gaddafi's wife Safia, his sons Hannibal and Mohammed, and his daughter Aisha have entered their country and presumably are seeking asylum. Would this be an official case of asylum?
Well, it will be interesting to see exactly how the Algerians handle it from here on out. This whole issue of the unfolding revolt, the violence and so on in neighboring Libya has been, it's a very interesting case following Algerian foreign policy, and analysts in the Algerian press themselves are sort of perplexed by the way that the regime has handled all of this. They feel that the diplomacy has been poor or lacking, and that the Algeria's strategy of communicating what it's doing or just trying to figure out what Algeria is doing has really been quite a problem. So it leaves Algeria sort of isolated regionally. Initially, Gaddafi had charged the Algerians with supporting the rebels, and then, of course, the rebels charged Algeria of supporting Gaddafi, which appears to be more close to the case. Just the full extent of the support, we don't know. What this will mean now for the fact that Gaddafi's wife, two sons, and his daughter have taken refuge there, I think the Transitional National Council has already said that they expect that the Algerians will return them for trial in Libya at the point at which Libya actually requests that. So that hasn't happened yet, but for now the Algerians, I think, have a very very sensitive diplomatic situation on their hands.
So, Laurie Brand, what would explain then the Algerian position? Because certainly the rebels in Libya believe, and they've accused Algeria of providing Gaddafi with mercenaries mm-hmm. to repress the revolt. My understanding is that that's pretty much been accepted by everybody in the neighborhood, that Algeria was on the side of Gaddafi, where everybody else wasn't, except for some African countries.
Right.
And Venezuela.
Well, I think we need to put it in the both the regional North African context as well as the larger context of what's been happening in the Arab world over the last 7 or 8 months. If you look at the Algerian reaction to the, you know, the unfolding revolt slash revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia, it was also kind of a deafening silence. They're also one of the few countries that hasn't taken a position critical of the Syrian regime and the current use of lethal force against its population. So it's quite clear, and you know, not surprisingly so in general, that all other things being equal, autocrats prefer other autocrats, and instability, particularly instability that might be leading to more to the establishment of political systems that might be more participatory, more democratic, is of concern. So in general, the Algerians' leadership would be concerned about that because, of course, Algeria is seemingly sort of stuck in its authoritarian military paradigm. Algeria, when I was there last March, talking to a number of people about, you know, why elsewhere, why not in Algeria, a number of Algerians said to me, well, we had our... we had our spring, we had our opportunity, our revolt in 88 and 89 when there were massive demonstrations. And actually, it was a massive change, a deep structural change in an important structural change in the political system, a move away from a one-party system to greater political pluralism. But then shortly thereafter, the country descended into this, what they call the dark decade, and whatever promise there was of real change was overturned. So in any event, it leaves the regime in Algeria one that is going to be highly sensitive, but in a very negative way, to these kinds of revolts and revolutions that may well bring more open political systems elsewhere in the region. In regional terms, there are other concerns that the Algerians have. One is that Gaddafi was a supporter of the Algerians, certainly in their ongoing contest or conflict with Morocco over the Western Sahara. So the Algerians are unhappy, certainly, to be losing a major supporter of theirs in the North African region for the Polisario's claim on the Western Sahara region. So that's an issue. It further empowers Morocco. And Morocco and Tunisia both have, basically from the early days, I think, of this Libyan revolt, extended feelers to the rebels and now have, put in place contacts. Tunisia's, I believe, has recognized the Transitional Council. Morocco recently sent a high-level delegation to Benghazi. So there are the other regional neighbors have already positioned themselves to establish good relations with whatever regime comes out of this revolt in Libya. So that's also of concern to the Algerians. And then the final thing I would say in terms of regional issues is simply the Algerian government's concern about stability in the Sahel region, in the Sahara, the degree to which Libya can, as one article that I was reading recently said, turn into sort of an open-air arms bazaar, particularly in the south, which would enable groups that would either the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb or other groups that continue to carry out attacks against the Algerian state provide them with continuing support. So these are all considerations that the Algerian regime is currently contending with.
Again, I'm speaking with USC Professor of International Relations, Laurie Brand. Well, apparently the arms bazaar is happening in Agadez in Niger. It's one of the biggest open air, and it's all, most of it is the looted military equipment from Libya. But I would think that the Tunisian and Moroccan involvement is in part there to deal with that, and the Algerians won't be able to deal with it if they have such frosty relationships with this new government, and because some of these arms apparently are going into the Polisario battle with the Moroccans, and all over the Maghreb apparently, these are, you know, there's these camel caravans all over the place apparently. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, again, it's just, Morocco, or no, I'm sorry, not Morocco, Algeria traditionally had its diplomacy had a fairly good reputation. I mean, there are a number of high-level Algerians who historically have been important negotiators and mediators in other conflicts. And in this particular instance, Algeria was silent. It sort of hedged where it was even though it became increasingly apparent that it was supporting the Libyan regime. It never really came out and made its position clear. I mean, it did, and I think understandably so, it expressed its concern that this was initially an internal Libyan affair. It expressed its reservations about the involvement of NATO, and that's not a terribly surprising position given sort of Algeria's history and its colonial past and concerns perhaps about neocolonialism in the region. What is unusual about this position for Algeria is that in the past it positioned itself, both in terms of its diplomacy as well as, I would say, discursively, as a leader of revolutionary movements. I mean, Algeria defined itself by its revolution, this revolution which was remarkable by Third World standards, by any standards, in fact. And that it was a continuation of this revolution, this championing of causes against against repression and so on, which has been a mainstay of the self-definition of the Algerian regime, and that all seems to have been pushed aside or put on the back burner in this particular instance.
So, Laurie Brand, you were saying earlier that. The Algerians felt that they had their Arab Spring a long time ago, at the time when there was a popular uprising against the military government, but it was always characterized as the Islamic Salvation Front, the FIS, that were really leading that. You're saying that there were more secular elements, and the brutality that followed with this bloody civil war, which was where both sides just resorted to insane and barbaric violence has just numbed the entire country. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Well, what I would say is, in 1988, there were major demonstrations, and in some ways, not unlike what we saw not unlike what we've seen in other countries in these most recent Arab revolts. Primarily the young, primarily spurred on by economic demands, but also decades of single-party rule, so that there were some important similarities. The FIS came out of that period of single-party rule as the strongest contender, the strongest potential opponent to the FLN. But certainly there were lots of people, sort of civil society, secularists, and maybe not just even secularists, but also people who weren't part of the FIS, who were extremely active during that period. It's just that the FIS emerged as the primary organized opponent of the state, and then because of its successes electorally, it led or triggered then a military coup, in effect. Prevented a second round of elections, and then the establishment of junta, and then the country descended into what Algerians actually take exception to calling it a civil war. They reject that. They call it the dark decade, or simply the period of terrorism. But they really don't like to call it a civil war. But yeah, there clearly was violence, very ugly violence, ugly massacres, assassinations of various sorts that the country experienced throughout the 1990s. And so clearly, one of the reasons why we haven't seen Algerians mobilize in a way comparable to or similar to what we've seen in other countries over the last several months is precisely, I think, because of the memory of that dark decade. It's not the only reason, I think, but I think it is it's a very important part of it. People are not only still exhausted from that, but they are very wary of any kind of developments that might upset what still appears to be, at some point, a relatively dicey calm. I mean, there were just during Ramadan, we've had a number of instances. Some of them, Al-Qaeda has taken credit for. Others, which are attacks by people who, groups that are not announcing responsibility for them. But nonetheless, numerous attacks during Ramadan. There's been a very bloody Ramadan for the Algerians. And so, with that still below the surface, there's a real concern on the part of people about pushing the state, even though there is also clearly broad discontent across sectors with the Algerian state at this point.
So do you think, Laurie Brand, that Gaddafi will also show up in Algeria?
It's a guess. I really don't know. I think it's unlikely, but you know, I could well be proven wrong tomorrow morning. Giving asylum to family members, particularly female family members, is one thing. There's, you know, that's sort of more acceptable to offer Gaddafi asylum in the current regional atmosphere. I think would be extremely problematic for the Algerians. I would be very surprised, actually, if we found that. But you know, I could be wrong.
Well, it's interesting that you know, the example of when the FIS won the elections and then the government voided the elections, that's always been cited as the MO for Islamists. And as you know, Gaddafi used the specter of Islamists to justify his own rule. And people were very concerned and still are today about the Egyptian revolution, the role of the Muslim Brotherhood. And the notion is that, you know, one vote, you know, they want democracy.
One man, one vote, one time.
Yeah, one man, one vote, one time. Right. But you're saying that there was a much broader cross-section of other democratic and secular forces in Algeria at the time, and they just got swept aside.
Well, they weren't as well organized. They weren't as large. And see, the FIS had the advantage, just as the Muslim Brotherhood has had in some of these other cases. I mean, in another country now is the sort of the return of Nahda in Tunisia. One of the biggest challenges in Tunisia right now is precisely this terrible suspicion, if not reaching the point of paranoia, between the secularists on one side and the Islamists in the form of Nahda on the other side. So this is a common, I think, theme or a common manifestation that we find in a number of these countries, because in the case of the FIS in Algeria, they were able to operate through the mosques. There had been tacit, if not overt, encouragement of a sort of Arabo-Islamic trend as part of Shadli bin Jazid's strategy for reinforcing his rule in the 1980s. And part of what that did was open up greater possibilities, freedom for particularly unauthorized mosques that were established in Algeria. Mosques in Algeria became formally authorized and therefore fell under the control of the government. In other words, the government would provide imams for them only once they were completely finished. So a lot of mosques were left formally unfinished, and so they could have these imams who would come not through any sort of state training, but from other places. So they had their own minbars from which to organize, and so the mosque really became an organizing space in Algeria, not unlike what we've seen, you know, in some other countries, where it is the Islamists that end up emerging as the most potent opponents of the dictatorial regimes. But I think, you know, we've also seen the gradual taming or the gradual modifying of the programs of a number of Islamist groups. It's one thing to be in opposition, it's another thing to actually have to rule. And oftentimes when these groups are given the opportunity to rule, they demonstrate that they're just as inept and inefficient as other as secular or as non-Islamist parties have been.
Well, just in the last minute then, Laurie Brand, just to look at the regional changes now that Gaddafi's all but finished and his son was apparently killed on Saturday, Hamis, who led the elite military brigade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's fairly likely that that Gaddafi's holed up in Sirte in his hometown.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, nobody knows. But his days are certainly numbered. And if you were mentioning earlier, the Moroccans and the Tunisians already establishing links with this new government. And this new government, through a spokesman, has already demanded to the Algerians that the Algerian authorities hand over Gaddafi's family to be tried in the Libyan courts. So already there's friction there between the new Libyan government and Algeria. So, what do you think of the sort of long term consequences here? If the Libyan regime is successful and there is they couldn't help but be a more democratic government, but a successful government there in Libya, how's that going to impact the neighborhood?
Well, I think the Algerian, and clearly you're absolutely right, there are tensions and there are resentments. I think that they are primarily directed at the Algerian government, not at the Algerian people, because I think in general the Algerian people have been very supportive of this Libyan revolt. So I think I saw someone interviewed recently who said as much. They understood that the government's position was quite different from that of the Algerian people. So that could help to ameliorate or serve as a basis for ameliorating relations in the future. A lot, I think, depends on how soon Gaddafi is found and what happens to him, how cooperative the Algerians are once the Libyans finally do make a formal demand, if in fact they do, and I assume they will, that these members of Gaddafi's family be turned over. If the Algerians cooperate in that, that could probably go a long way toward helping to soothe over relations. There's also the question of security cooperation, which the Algerians are going to be very keen on. In fact, one Algerian spokesman, although I think this is rather disingenuous, said that their recognition of the transitional National Council would depend first on the National Council's demonstration of its ability to crack down on Al-Qaeda, which is really kind of, you know, ridiculous. But clearly security cooperation is going to be a top concern of the Algerians as well. So I clearly, relations are bad now. They're strained, but I don't think that that what has happened means they're irreparably broken. A lot depends on how the Algerians respond now that it's clear that Gaddafi is finished, if they're able to sort of regroup and try and bounce back from what's been a fairly chaotic and in some ways hard to explain diplomacy.
Well, thank you for joining us here today, Laurie Bragg. Again, I've been speaking with the USC Professor of International Relations, Laurie Brand, who is the Robert Granford Wright Professor, and she's also she specializes in North African, Middle East, International Relations, and Inter-Arab Politics, and she's the past president of the Middle East Studies Association of North America. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the big storm back east and its connection to climate change. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andrew Refkin, who is a reporter for The New York Times and creator of The New York Times' .earth blog, where he has covered global environmental issues that have included climate change, Hurricane Katrina, the Asian tsunami, science policy and politics, and the North Pole. He has served as adjunct professor at Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism, teaching environmental reporting, and is the senior fellow for environmental understanding at Pace University. His books include The Burning Season, The Murder of Chico Mendez, and The Fight for the Amazon Rainforest, Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast, and The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Refkin.
Good to be with you.
And do you think, I suppose it's pretty clear that given that Hurricane Irene was not as devastating as was expected, I think the political subtext there always, surely, Andrew, was that was Katrina, right? That all the politicians didn't want to repeat that mistake.
Well, yeah, and the point you raised depends on whose expectations you're talking about. I mean, the climate and the weather forecasters that I was keeping in touch with were always indicating, you know, there's always uncertainty, and anyone who said there was a forecast of a devastating storm was looking at hype, not at reality. The media had expectations that did sort of overblow, I think, things in a way that when you really look at what the National Hurricane Center was putting out, is not what the actual forecasts were. It's really important to look at those. They have a zone. You know, everyone looks at the track and thinks that there's a line that this hurricane is going to follow. And in fact, it's that bubble around the track that there's not even a sense of probability within that bubble about where that storm will be. So I do think it's important to deflate the idea that this was badly forecast in that sense.
Well,
begs the question of, like, you know, the political ramifications and stuff.
Well, no, but the point you've raised is one that I've been aware of, and we have it out here all the time in California. Every time a storm front comes through, and you see the pictures over the Pacific, it's billed with theme music, Storm Front 2011, with triple Doppler radar. And
correspondence tied to telephone poles.
Yeah, so I'm just sick. It culminated, of course, when they closed the freeway down. You know, they call it Carmageddon. There was so much hype that the entire city was going to be paralyzed and people would be shooting each other over a can of tuna. And in fact, it was a beautiful weekend where you could hear the birds and relax in the garden with your family.
Right. And now, getting at the other point about how do you gauge an emergency response when you have a certain level of uncertainty and you have all that hype? It's a tough question. I think the mayor of New York did the right thing by calling for those evacuations, because all it takes is a few hours, a few tweaks of the trajectory, a few factors in the atmosphere going in the other direction, and you have a much more powerful storm and a bigger surge. And the question, of course, and this comes up in tornado country too, which is even worse, how do you maintain vigilance and responsiveness when you have a high false alarm rate, which is the case with tornadoes all the time, and with hurricanes much more rarely. But even there, it's still an issue. How do you get people to evacuate when most experience with evacuations isn't the worst case? It's a tough question.
Well, Andrew Rifkin, given that the press did overblow it, and you're saying that if you had listened carefully to what the weather people were saying, and the professional hurricane forecasters, that it wasn't going to be as bad as it was hyped. Is it true that the press missed? They were so focused on storm surges and others, they have missed the second stage, which is all of that rain that's now causing flooding up in New England in particular? Or is that yet more media hype? Because that seemed to be...
No, it's not. In fact, I live halfway up the Hudson Valley, and we've had a disastrous, not disastrous in terms of lost lives, but disastrous in terms of impacts on roads and ultimately on economies, people not being able to get to work and stuff. I must say, if people had been reading .earth, they would have known. My second post, way back on Tuesday, I wrote a piece that basically said the flood risk is likely to be the big thing. And I didn't mean coastal flooding. This is a rainfall storm, and because it was very reminiscent, looking at it, of Hurricane Floyd, which became much, much more destructive, which had a lot of destruction as a tropical storm, compared to what it had a lot of impact on the Carolinas, which are fairly sparsely populated as a powerful hurricane, but in 1999 it had a terrible impact in the Northeast as just a drenching rainmaker. And that's, in fact, what we saw here. There's towns in the Catskills right now that I haven't gotten to, but I've been there in epic floods before, and I know what they're facing, which is sort of Katrina-style people on rooftops.
And has that reached its peak, the flooding
Some rivers are still rising because of the sort of a delay in the system, but mm-hmm. most are at peak or not, or past it.
So that's really where the damage was done by this hurricane, not on the coast but inland.
Yeah, absolutely. And there too, you know, coasts in general, people who live on vulnerable coasts outside of places like New York City perhaps do know how to behave. There's still an unfortunate habit in this country of subsidizing hurricane, you know, sort of storm insurance in places where people simply shouldn't be building. And so that leads to this unbelievable phenomenon that I saw firsthand in 2004 when I was covering Hurricane Ivan in Alabama. And I went to this place called Dauphin Island, kind of like a low-key version of the Hamptons, or where you have houses built right on the beach, and people were just basically looking at the waves destroying their houses and saying they know they're going to get a check in the mail and build back bigger the next time. And it just was utterly aggravating to see that mindset at work.
Well, you're beginning to sound like Ron Paul.
Well, you know, I hate irrational subsidy. Sure, my God.
Well, it's no accident, of course, that these people are extremely wealthy, and they've probably got political connections. So,
The ones in Alabama were more middle class.
I see.
That's what I meant.
So this is not Malibu, Malibu in the South, right?
Blue-collar Malibu.
So, again, I'm speaking with Andrew Refkin, who is a reporter for The New York Times and creator of the New York Times' .earth blog, where he has covered global environmental issues that included climate change and, of course, hurricanes. And we're talking about Hurricane Irene, which Andrew has told us was actually forecast correctly but somewhat overblown by press hype. But nevertheless, real damage is being done inland by the enormous amount of rainfall and the flooding that's happening. What is the climate change angle here? Because clearly we've been having series of extreme weather events with more frequency, with more intensity, and at some point or other we're going to run out of money with these federal disaster loans.
Yeah, well, in this instance, it's important to not lump all disastrous weather into one batch and say it's all global warming. Tornadoes, for example, the science just isn't there to find that link. So while there is clear, we had an unbelievable tornado season this year, epic damage, the damage toll was substantially because there's so many more people living in the southeast and sort of Tornado Alley and the adjacent areas than there were 50 years ago or 100 years ago, the last time similar fronts came through. So it's just really important to not sort of oversimplify the situation. Now, that said, expectations are, and actually recent history for heavy downpours is that in North America, at the very least, there's a tendency toward having more rain, more of the rain that comes coming in heavy downpours. And that, again, hurricanes, as I just explained, and as we just witnessed, a big chunk of their damage can come through rain as opposed to wind and coastal flooding. So, and then you when you add sea level rise, which is one of the most basic results of warming the planet, then you are talking about rising vulnerability to storms of this kind. It could be, and there's a chunk of science pointing to this, that there'll be fewer hurricanes overall in a warmer or warming world than there are now. The chances of hurricanes once forming, getting into more intense scale categories is probably higher. And all of this is still in contention within the scientific community. This is not false controversy. This is real controversy because we don't understand hurricanes very well. They live or die based on very complicated mix of factors. And they're rare, so you don't have a statistical picture that's clear.
But I recall at the time of Katrina, as it was coming in, that there was talk that there was a global warming effect because the ocean was warmer. But
that
was just
Katrina was incorrectly. I think it's pretty clear now, and I think a lot of hurricane and climate researchers would agree that there's no clear picture there. In fact, I remember it was a very weak storm over New Orleans. Once the winds over the city were actually, I think, Category 1 or below, and there the problem was vulnerability. The city had never been adequately armored on the side away from the Mississippi River, and you had a city that would have gone under sooner or later by some hurricane, whether or not you had global warming. It was almost inevitable. It did go over a warm pocket of water, but the Gulf of Mexico every year is a mixture of loop currents. I wrote about them. They even have names. Scientists give them names that can bring sort of really unusually hot water around. But right now, the Gulf is actually not at a very hot level compared to some recent years. So there are no straight lines you can draw. And again, it sounds almost boring and kind of counter to what would be a headline thought, but, you know, in a warming world, you will expect storms to be more severe, but you can't presume that there was any you know, looking at a storm like Katrina, you can't ever blame a single storm or its outcome on this thing, this impact.
So,
which
but
is really, again, the natural variability year to year is still greater than what's thought to have happened already from warming.
So since this is not, there's no cause and effect here to global warming, is that to say then that global warming deniers will have more ammunition? We've got a guy running for president now.
Who's
the head of the Republican PAC, I might add.
one of the tough realities here is people who want stasis, people who don't want us to move off of fossil fuels, have a very easy task, because I say it's almost like another law of physics. Society at motion a society at rest tends to stay at rest. Human beings on fossil fuels is a very comfortable and it's like being deeply sunk into a couch, and getting someone off that couch requires an enormous amount of effort, and having them stay on the couch requires almost no effort. So those who want to keep us in our current mindset have this unbelievably easy task. All they need is a tiny little bit of uncertainty. And unfortunately, the science of climate change will always give that just enough of that stuff that they'll probably have their easy task accomplished. And it's not because, it's not like each side has an equivalent challenge here. And that's what makes this very hard energy policy so hard to push forward in America.
But I think Rick Perry's notion that scientists are going wild and running off half-cocked
is
total
panicking.
Nonsense, because if you talk to any scientist, every scientist I ever talked to, they are the most conservative people on the planet. They do not get out ahead of their own information.
No. And I just wrote a piece today chastising the conservative columnist George Will for not going after these Republican frontrunners, as he did in January. When the new Republican Congress House came in, George Will, of all people, wrote a column saying, don't diss science. Science, the Republican Party needs to be cognizant of and a leader on this nation restoring its scientific leadership. And here, you have people like Governor Rick Perry trying to sort of demean and throw doubt on all of climate science on the basis of a few stray threads that were a short-term news story and that have no real ramifications for the overall body of evidence pointing to a human heated planet. And George Will in earlier columns made the same fallacious argument that just essentially trying to toxify the whole enterprise on the basis of a few controversies, and that's a regrettable thing, especially when Will in another column says we really have to care about science and give scientists support they need to make this country a leader again. You kind of can't have it both ways.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Andrew Refkin.
It's my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Refkin, who is a reporter for The New York Times and creator of The New York Times' .earth blog, where he's covered global environmental issues that have included climate change, Hurricane Katrina, the Asian tsunami, and science, policy, and politics. His books include The Burning Season, The Murder of Chico Mendez, and The Fight for the Amazon Rainforest, Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast, and The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking to a CIA interrogator about torture. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Glenn Carl, who is the author of a new book, The Interrogator, An Education. Glenn Carl was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in March 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. Welcome to Background Briefing, Glenn Carl.
Thank you for having me.
And do you think that your book is a very powerful personal journey of a struggle where you're trying to fulfill your oath to preserve and protect the Constitution and obtain critical information about terrorist operations at the same time aware of this country's moral standing? And you were given the impossible task, I guess, to do wrong in order to do right.
Well, I wrote the book as well as I could to be a personal story. I wanted this to be something that would live for any average American if they read it. I want them to understand what a man feels or sees or the decisions that he has to make, or that I had to make, or that they would have had to make in my position, rather than writing a dry political tome about rendition, detention, interrogation, etc. These are all very important, critical issues, but I wanted someone to feel what we have done to ourselves and the choices that we all have to think about.
And in your case, you were interrogating what was supposed to be one of the most senior al-Qaeda detainees the CIA had captured.
Yes. Well, when I was first briefed on the case, I was told that we've captured one of the top, say, half dozen members of al-Qaeda. That's a pretty big fish. We call them high-value targets, and there were very few of them. We've captured hundreds of people over the 10 years since the attacks of 9/11, but only a small number of them are the senior members of the terrorist organization. So we thought, I was told, that he might be able to lead us to bin Laden, and at the least, he would help us learn how to seriously damage al-Qaeda as an organization. So it was a very important case and a high honor to be involved in it at all at first.
But it sort of slowly dawns on you that they've got the wrong guy. And the more that you become skeptical of the notion that this guy's a high-value target and is of some intelligence value, the more pressure there is to get nastier.
Yes, well, that's exactly right. I entered intelligence is always a confusing business where you have to square the circle repeatedly, but that's the job. In this case, though, just as you say, I went from the signal honor, great opportunity for the CIA and the United States government, as I described it, to pretty quickly feeling myself as I was the one interrogating the man. I was the one sitting across from him looking into his eyes. That, in fact, he was not what we had assessed him to be. I started, even before my discovery that he wasn't what we thought, very troubled by the orders I had been given, because the orders, to me, quite clearly contradicted our entire heritage and some specific laws that we had. But I had been told, because I expressly asked, I'd been told that the president had directly authorized and ordered the program that I was being brought into, and that it was legal, even though I challenged it from the first seconds again, as being in contradiction with the Convention Against Torture and the Geneva Conventions. So I was troubled from the get-go, and then, as you say, at first I thought, I'm learning here that the man is not what we had assessed. He's not a senior member of al-Qaeda. He's not a member of al-Qaeda. The methods I'm being told to use, not only do they not work and be legally challengeable, but they're a problem from every conceivable angle, moral, legal, practicality. They just are wrong. And then that raised even larger problems because, as you say, when the more I said, well, he's answered the following questions truthfully and he doesn't know the answers to certain other questions, I was ordered, well, and this is literally true, it will sound insane, but it is literally true. I was told the fact that he has not answered proves that he is withholding information
therefore he is guilty, therefore you must pressure him more. Pressure means to use whatever means I could come up with. And I just thought that that was crazy from the get-go. I mean, the fact that he doesn't answer is taken as proof of guilt, so the man's doomed no matter what he answered. If he answered, he's guilty, and if he doesn't, he's guilty. It was crazy.
Again, I'm speaking with Glenn Carl, 23-year veteran of the CIA's clandestine service, who retired in March of 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. He's the author of The Interrogator, An Education. Now, you didn't go in there, though, with the kind of, you know, that Fox show 24, the ticking bomb. Isn't that the core defense that there is for torture, that, you know, you've got a ticking nuclear car bomb in a city full of millions of people, and the niceties of the Geneva Convention simply can't apply because too many lives are at stake?
Right. Well, that's the ticking time bomb scenario is the one most dear to the neocons and Vice President Cheney's heart, and that is the justification, theoretically, the justification for enhanced interrogation measures, that you will do whatever, I was told, here's a direct quote, you will do whatever it takes to get him to talk. Unstated was because there might be this ticking time bomb, and so you have to find out the information by any means. But it's not only foolish and impractical, it just makes no sense whatsoever to base both your law and your practice, I'm talking about the practical approach here, based on the theoretical possibility that something might be the case, when in fact we know, one, that has never been the case. I don't think there's any specific instance when this ticking time bomb scenario has ever had any relation to reality. And two, you don't base your practices, your laws, your methods on something that will happen maybe one time in 10 million. What you do is you base all of these procedures, guidelines, and so on, on the overwhelming likelihood of what will happen. And you set, there's a moral, a legal, and a practical consideration to take, rather than a theoretical one. If you use the theoretical one that Cheney uses, this ticking time bomb thing, you could say, well, and I'm not making a joke here, you could say, okay, if someone takes a high school chemistry text and gets it from the public library, they might be able to learn how to make a bomb. And then they might blow up the train station and kill 400 people. We can't have that. We must remove all high school textbooks from every library in the United States to be safe. There's no difference, really, between that and the ticking time bomb scenario. It's completely crazy to do as a justification, because by that standard, the slightest hint or indication that someone may conceivably be a problem for the United States justifies kidnapping the guy and torturing him. And that's insane.
Well, that, was, of course, was Dick Cheney's 1% doctrine. But what do you make then, Glenn Carl, of Cheney's comeback, if you will? He's got a new book coming out tomorrow, and he's already appeared in friendly interviews justifying torture. And frankly, I find it incomprehensible, just as someone who tries to analyze foreign policy, that the average American doesn't understand the enormous damage that Cheney and company did to the United States, because people like Gaddafi and the Assads and all of those murderous dictators around the world who are torturing their own people are now free to say, well, you know, the Americans do it, so what's your problem?
Well, it's shocking from every conceivable level. Americans should not even be discussing this. There is no debate to have at all. Every American in uniform, officer from the general grade officer down to the lowest private, can tell you that the Geneva Conventions, which the United States literally wrote, it was Eleanor Roosevelt who represented the United States after World War II and was the drafter, the primary drafter of the Geneva Conventions, that the Geneva Conventions and rules of war and comportment in conflict, and will include the supposed war on terror and counterterrorism actions in there, Americans benefit from trying to codify and regulate behavior. One need not be and should not be barbarous and unrestrained entirely. And I argue, as I think every American would support, would feel the same way, that wherever the American flag holds sway, wherever we exert our influence, so must our laws and our standards. And if they don't, then every American in uniform or out, from General Powell to anonymous case officer Carl, can be subject to hideous treatment that we would consider, and President Bush himself denounced vehemently, as barbarous torture. And that's just simply wrong, impractical, and inconceivable. Now, with respect to Vice President Cheney, you know, there's no surprise there whatsoever. Of course, someone who advocated, drafted, implemented, and ordered and implemented the policies is not going to repudiate them, because that would make him a war criminal, and someone who would acknowledge error, which he, of course, has never done, I think, for that matter, very few senior politicians ever do. But in a matter of war, in which, as I write quite explicitly about in my book, I describe exactly what Cheney was going to do, and he's done exactly that, which is to deny everything, affirm everything, nothing is wrong, and critics are the only ones who prove their culpability by criticizing my policies. It's just there's nothing new whatsoever. And frankly, if you want to know something new about the war on terror and the dilemmas we faced, you should read my book rather than listening to the bromides and self-justifications of Vice President Cheney.
Well, do you think this is the case of the best defense is an offense? That, I mean, is there any chance that because it seems like President Obama essentially got Cheney off the hook. I mean, is there any chance
President Obama got Cheney off the hook?
Well, in the sense that. Well, I'm saying that is there any possibility of any of these cases reaching the vice president? I mean, it's no question. I think people who know, they know that John Yoo, Addington, and Cheney and company all just made this stuff up. You were given orders by Cheney to do this. I don't know what the president was doing at the time, but the long and the short of it is these guys are guilty, and I don't see anybody coming after them. And my understanding is that this current president decided not to pursue these matters because it simply was opening too much of a can of worms. And that's why.
Yes, now I understand. And actually, on this point, I agree with President Obama and his administration's decision. And I agree with them not because I want to protect the guilty, but rather because the most important objective to me, is to have the American public as a whole shift its view progressively back to what it was, to repudiate torture and these measures far more clearly. I'm afraid, and I explore this, I describe this in the last chapter of my book, I'm afraid that were we to prosecute any people for these actions in the government, that we would divide our society more and polarize it more, and that would not, I'm afraid, shift the views of people whose views might be changed with respect to torture. And if the cost of increasing our repudiation of these methods is to let a few people, frankly, lead their lives more or less unmolested. That's a price I'm willing to pay. I think one of the triumphs of American society has been our reconciliations and moving ahead and changing practices that we oppose rather than seeking vengeance in a way and punishing the guilty. That was the triumph of after the Civil War. We didn't have a terrible series of retributions, really. I think Obama got it right.
Well, just in closing, Glenn Carr, given that you the agency, your book is full of redactions, and clearly they tried to sanitize your account of what happened. Ali Soufran, the FBI agent who was involved in the same area that you were working in, his book is the CIA holding it up and supposedly censoring it because he one of the things that Soufran argues in the book is that the CIA missed a chance to derail 2001 plot by the 9/11 plot by withholding from the FBI information about two future 9/11 hijackers living in San Diego. I take it you must have some sympathies for him. Just got a minute to go here.
I do. Well, Mr. Soufran and I have never met, but he and I, our assessments of the right way to interrogate and what we've done wrong are identical, actually. His dilemmas with the review board are identical to what I suffered through for over 2 years. And it does sound as though the only reason to keep the information that he talks about out is to avoid humiliation or embarrassment or a look back at things that we got wrong.
I thank you. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us here, Glenn Carl. Again, Glenn Carl is the author of the new book, The Interrogator, in Education. He was a member of the CIA's clandestine services for 23 years and retired in March of 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, given that Gaddafi's family, his wife and a couple of his sons, have shown up in Algeria, I thought it'd be a good idea to look into Algeria. The Algerian military regime that brutally crushed their Islamic opposition over a 10-year civil war have been sympathetic to Gaddafi and unsympathetic to the rebels. The rebels are very angry about this. They've demanded the return of these people for trial in Libya. So I wanted to find out about what the regional implications are for this new government in Libya and the toppling of this long dictatorship. And clearly, in the neighborhood, the Tunisians and the Egyptians want Gaddafi to go, as do the Moroccans, but not necessarily the Algerians. So what happened to the Arab Spring in Algeria? Well, apparently it happened a long time ago, when the Islamic Salvation Front won the election, and immediately the government, the military, cancelled the elections, and thus a 10-year brutal struggle ensued. Laurie Brand, Professor of International Relations at USC, who studies North Africa, explained this history and suggested that there would be some perhaps further isolation of Algeria as a result of this, that there is always been a distinction between the government and the people in Algeria. And even though they're exhausted by 10 years of bloodletting, that doesn't mean that their aspirations aren't any different from the Egyptians and the Libyans. So that was an interesting analysis. And then I spoke with Andrew Revkin, who's the New York Times, creator of the New York Times' Dot Earth blog. He covers environmental issues and climate change. So I asked him about the hurricane, he said it was indeed hyped by the press, that if you actually listen to what the weathermen said, it wasn't going to be quite as big an event. He said, however, just as much as they overhyped the hurricane coming ashore, they didn't predict the amount of flooding inland from all that rain. And that is indeed a real problem, he said. And then in terms of climate change, science the struggle that's going on, particularly with the emergence of a major climate change denier, Rick Perry, he pointed out that it's so much easier to be in denial than to sit on the couch and just accept that nothing can be done than the tough choices ahead. And pointed out, of course, that scientists are the last people that exaggerate. The most interesting person of all was the last guest, which is the CIA officer who was involved in interrogating Al-Qaeda suspects. And he really did have a lot to say about Dick Cheney and torture, which really blew my mind. He was quite outspoken about Cheney's criminality, and that he said his orders came directly from Cheney. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.